This is Bill Tiller of Tiller.org. You're listening to BBSRadio.com. Don't forget to tune in to The Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr every Sunday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Enjoy.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and I have tonight as my guest Dr. Stanley Krippner. We're going to be talking about his latest book, Haunted by Combat. How are you, Dr. Krippner?
I'm fine, thank you, and I appreciate you having me on your show.
Oh, it's my pleasure, my pleasure. I have to tell you, this is a very hard interview for me to do because my son is sitting in Baghdad tonight. So it's hard for me to have to hear all of the things that he's going through, probably, and the things that's going to happen when he comes home.
Yes, it's a very difficult time for many families, not only in the United States, but for families in Baghdad and families in other parts of the world whose sons and daughters are involved in the conflict.
It really is. So what is post-traumatic stress? Well, first of all, tell us a little bit about you and what brought you to write this book and where people can find you so they'll know who we're listening to tonight.
Well, our book is called Haunted by Combat, because about one out of every four servicemen or servicewomen who come back from combat, Iran, Afghanistan, Vietnam, etc., have some form of what we call trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder. This means that their lives are not quite the same, they're disordered, because they are suffering in some way or another from the trauma, from the shock, from the stress, from the brutality that they encountered or that they witnessed while they were in combat. So that's why we call our book Haunted by Combat. I wrote the book with Daryl Paulson, who is a psychotherapist. He actually does psychotherapy with men and women who have been in the last several American wars, and he was a Vietnam veteran himself. My own interest goes back to World War II because I had a cousin who was imprisoned by the Japanese in the Philippines, and she was never the same when she came back to the United States. And looking back at it now, I realize that she was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder.
Now, you have a long history of also researching consciousness, don't you?
Yes, I've done a great deal of work in consciousness studies. And so what I have learned in my work with altered states of consciousness and my work with hypnosis, my work with dreams, all came together in the writing of this book, because hypnosis is one of the many, many effective types of psychotherapy that can be used. And nightmares, nighttime frightening dreams, are one of the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Interesting. Before we get started on your book, I'd like to know what your definition of consciousness is. I ask everybody this question because I find it goes all over the board. So what is your definition of consciousness?
Well, from a psychological point of view, I simply define consciousness as a pattern of perception and emotion and thinking that characterizes somebody or some animal or bird or other living being at any point in time and in any specific space in the world. In other words, consciousness is always local. It's always delimited to a specific time and place. And every now and again, consciousness can be unlocal and non-local. In other words, it can extend into the past, into the future, into a distant place, and we even see that in combat disorders. My co-author, Daryl Paulson, has written an article about non-local consciousness and combat. So if we start out by very simply talking about consciousness as an overall term, like an umbrella that covers feelings and thinking and perceiving, then we can simply go on from there and be very specific in terms of what type of consciousness we're talking about.
Okay. Maybe I should have you back and talk just about that sometime. So what is the difference between post-traumatic stress and post-traumatic stress syndrome?
Post-traumatic stress can occur without it actually being a disorder, without it being a syndrome. And in our book, Haunted by Combat, we talk about the whole spectrum. Some people have post-traumatic stress after seeing their friends blown up in front of their faces or seeing children shot by accident by what's called friendly fire, or simply seeing planes going down that they know have friends of theirs aboard in the military or even non-military, because post-traumatic stress disorder and post-traumatic stress occur in other forms of civilian life as well. But when we simply say post-traumatic stress, we mean something that can be handled. People can assimilate the experience, can get on with their lives, can keep their marriages together, can keep their relationships together, can keep their jobs, and can incorporate the frightening, scary, shocking experience into their stream of consciousness. But it becomes a disorder when the stress interferes with their lives, when their marriages fall apart, when they can't hold a job, when they have recurring nightmares, when they get headaches, when they have some type of symptom that is difficult for them to manage, and so they cannot get on with their lives.
Is it always caused by a specific event, or is it caused by numerous events, like childhood things, cumulative things?
Did you say, is it always the result of a specific stress?
Is it always caused by a specific event, or a cumulative effect of several events?
Sometimes it can be one specific stress. Let's talk about civilian life. If a woman or even a man is raped, that is a specific stress that might haunt them for the rest of their lives. If they cannot assimilate the experience, if they cannot get therapy, if they cannot work through the experience. On the other hand, there can be a series of stressful events, like we find in combat, where soldiers can maybe assimilate the death of one friend, but over the course of a year, if they lose five or six friends, it reached the breaking point, and that's when the nightmares start, that's when the syndrome comes in that interferes with their work. So, again, it's on a spectrum. Also, I should mention that in our book, Haunted by Combat, we talk about predisposing factors. There are actually some people who are genetically predisposed to have PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and other people who are predisposed in terms of coming from a home background that was unstable, a home background there was a lot of violence and abuse in the home background, and they're much more vulnerable to stress disorders than other people. So we have the predisposing factors. And then we have the actuating factors, the factors that bring on the stress, like the rape or the violence or the combat. And then we have the maintaining factors, what's keeping up the factor, what's making it impossible for them to assimilate these events into their life. And again, some people can assimilate much better and much more easily than others. For others, they go back into a civilian situation where there is an unstable home situation, where there is violence, where there are constant reminders of the trauma, and so this maintains the disorder.
I see.
So we have to think of past, present, and future as part of the picture that that we're dealing with when somebody is haunted by combat.
Is the post-traumatic stress syndrome, the symptoms, do they present right away, or is it something that occurs over time and kind of catches them off guard?
Actually, first aid that can be given right away is a very effective way of preventing the stress from becoming a stress disorder. This is something that the Israeli troops have access to in their mental health facilities and have for several decades. And American troops in Iraq and Afghanistan are beginning to learn this lesson. And even though it's not widely practiced, there are centers now, there are facilities, there are psychiatrists and psychologists who are able to work with a soldier or another member of the service right after the stress has occurred, right after they see a plane go down, right after they see a buddy blown up, right after they see a family being murdered. And if intervention can take place immediately, and if the therapist can give them some sort of emotional first aid, some sort of support, then the chances of this becoming a disorder are much less. And again, you never can tell who is going to be more prone to a disorder than somebody else, but the emotional and the therapeutic first aid certainly cannot help but be beneficial.
What kind of treatment is that? Because I know some therapists aren't trained to do this, so what kind of help would that be?
Therapy comes immediately, it can be as simple as having the member of the service, whether it's Marines or Air Force or Army or Navy or Coast Guard or Reserves or National Guard or whatever, simply tell the story over and over again while the therapist helps them to make some sense out of it, like saying, look, bad things happen to good people. This is one of the casualties of war. This is something that you signed up to do, and it's something that comes with the job. And by making it a part of the fabric of the service person's life, it can begin to make sense, and they can begin to assimilate it.
Okay.
Also, the psychotherapist can say, I know how you feel. I've had experiences like this myself. They can do a little group therapy. They can pull people together who can share experiences. Talking about it, working it through right away can be extremely valuable. Now, several months later, it's not so easy. But there's a type of therapy called implosion therapy, where, again, the veteran talks through the experience and then re-experiences it with virtual reality goggles where they can sort of see a simulated effect, and that takes them back to the experience and they can work it through with the therapist's help. They can use hypnosis, can relive the experience with hypnosis. There are some medications that can be helped. They don't solve the problem by themselves, but they can at least provide a calming effect while the therapy is taking place. There are cognitive behavioral therapies, there are psychodynamic therapies, there are existential therapies, we talk about all of those in our book, that can be used if the member of the armed forces, male or female, elects to have the therapy. The problem is that many of them think that this will look bad on their military record, and so they refuse the therapy, and then they get worse and worse. They're not effective at their jobs, not effective in their relationships. So turning away from the therapy is not an especially wise idea. And then there are other people who want the therapy. They get on a waiting list, and they might have to wait 3 or 4 or 5 months for the therapy because the part of the country they're in and the Veterans Administration Hospital, which is providing the therapy, doesn't have an opening for them.
You
can see, therapy can be very effective, whether it's done immediately or whether it's done on returning home, but the therapist has to be skilled and the therapist has to be available.
Do the individuals realize when they're in the midst of it what's going on, that they're having a problem? Does that make sense?
You're talking about the families?
The soldier.
Well, the individual will usually know that he or she is having a problem because they have flashbacks. They're reliving the experience. They, whether they're still overseas or whether they're at home, if there's a loud noise, they might duck for cover. They might react as if there's an actual explosion from an IED, an improvised explosive device, which has killed so many service people overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan. Yeah, so they will know it if they have a flashback. Also, they'll certainly know it if they have nightmares, and that's one of the most common sequelae or symptoms of a post-traumatic stress disorder. Also, they'll know it if they cannot focus, if they cannot concentrate on their job, and if they cannot relate to people, especially when they get back home. If their relationships start to fall apart, they know very well that this is connected with the stress. And the veterans that I've talked with, whether they go to therapy or not, yes, they know it. They can sense that they are not the same person they were before they went overseas.
Okay.
And again, this occurs with people who have experienced other types of stress in civilian life, people in automobile accidents, people who witness a murder, people who have been sexually or emotionally abused, and they say, you know, I'm not the same person I was before I had that experience. So by and large, they are aware that something has happened, and then it's up to them whether they want to go to a competent therapist to get help.
Mm-hmm.
And I say a competent therapist because trauma training is a very specialized type of training, and a psychotherapist, whether he or she is a psychologist or a psychiatrist or a social worker or a pastoral counselor, really needs to have specialized training to deal with the trauma effectively.
How do we know if the therapist, I mean, if an individual, say my son, for example, wanted to go how do you know which one's qualified?
I think that, first of all, if the veteran goes to a VA, a Veterans Administration hospital or clinic, they'll know that the therapist there has been trained in trauma. Otherwise, they wouldn't be holding that job. I know several therapists who work with the Veterans Administration, and I consider them very fine people, very competent people, even though they admit to me that there's a longer waiting list than they have time to see, and sometimes their time with each veteran has to be too short, which is why sometimes too much medication is given. Sometimes the veteran is relegated to group therapy when maybe individual therapy is needed first. In terms of going to a therapist who is in private practice, the veteran could simply ask, what experience have you had with trauma? And they could ask, are you a member of one of the professional associations that deals with trauma? There are two professional associations in the United States which consist of therapists who are specialists in trauma, and there are even certificates, training programs that are given. There are credentials that they can put on their office wall to indicate that they have had trauma training.
Okay. So are there, outside of the obvious mind symptoms, are there actual physiological symptoms that occur?
Yes, there certainly are. We go into the physiology of trauma in our book, Haunted by Combat, and there are different reactions in the endocrine system, in the way that the neurotransmitters activate the brain. You take a brain scan of the people who have suffered trauma and who have post-traumatic stress disorder, and you see that the emotional centers of the brain and the limbic system and the hippocampus areas of the brain are much more sensitive and overactive, overreacting to stimuli that come in. So there is a physiological change in the brain and the body of people who are haunted by combat and who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder.
Does that physiological change stay forever, or can it be reprogrammed?
The good news is that with proper treatment, the physiology can go back to what it was before the trauma, at least to a great extent. And this is where therapy and physiology interact very, very nicely, because the therapist can pick up the physiology simply by observing the veteran and seeing the eyes blinking, seeing the nose twitching, seeing the mouth stammering, seeing the hands trembling, seeing the feet fidgeting, And after some time in therapy, the therapist can notice a decrease in these symptoms, even without looking at a brain scan, even without having a more expensive and more comprehensive psychoneurological test done.
Interesting. You talked about neurotransmitters, and I really have an interest there. Is there a specific neurotransmitter that they notice that has a predominance, like the norepinephrine or the...
Well, yes, the serotonin level is damaged by post-traumatic stress disorder. Serotonin is one of the key neurotransmitters. It facilitates logical thinking, planning ahead. It's very important for many, many cognitive skills. And also, I would say that there are neurotransmitters that are connecting the three basic centers of the body, the brain, the heart, and the gut and the intestines. There are neurotransmitters in all three of these places. And so somebody who's been traumatized can feel the trauma in their gut. They can feel it in their heart as well as getting a headache and feeling it in the head. So it's not simply a matter of these neural networks interacting with each other and overreacting to perceived stimuli that remind somebody of the trauma. It's a matter of this lattice work of neurotransmitters and neural networks that are making the person ultra sensitive to re-experiencing the trauma.
So would it be beneficial for someone to take neurotransmitter support like SAMe or something like that along the way?
I didn't quite catch your question. Try it again.
Would it be beneficial for a person to take some natural supplement that supports the serotonin levels like SAMe or
that's a very good question. My own opinion is that somebody who has a stress disorder should watch their nutrition very closely. I think that a good multivitamin, multimineral supplement is a good place to start. Also, if they go to a nutritionist, they can find out what foods and what supplements are especially helpful in terms of facilitating neurotransmitter balance in the body.
Mm-hmm.
The vitamin B complex supplements, for example, fresh and raw fruits and vegetables, whole grain foods, that's another example.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one of the problems we see constantly with veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder is that often they lose interest in eating, which is a shame because food can be a very helpful
mm-hmm.
nutrient for them.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, I hate to say it, but instead they often engage in alcohol abuse and drug abuse and try to use alcohol and drugs to deaden the pain or distract them from the nightmares and the reminders of war and combat, when that money and that time could be better used in terms of preparing for themselves or having somebody else prepare them some delicious and nutritious food that would help the brain retain its and regain its balance.
Mm-hmm. What about their autonomic nervous system? What I would imagine they would need support there as well.
The autonomic nervous system, of course, is extremely important for people with stress disorder. This is the part of the nervous system which operates automatically, and it's the part of the nervous system that often is out of control when somebody reacts to noises, to faces, to perceived threats, to situations where they might get a little bit suspicious or even paranoid that something is going on that shouldn't be going on, and their heart starts racing and their hands start trembling and they get involved in what's called the fight and or flight syndrome, where they either freeze or they run away. And this is all defensive, and this is automatic on their part. It's something that serves them very well during combat, and it's something that during human evolution really helped to preserve people who were in great danger, but it's completely inappropriate to adapting to the civilian life.
So how do you support that? Electrolytes, water? What do you do?
I would say that there are a number of ways to support the veteran. One of them is simple relaxation exercises, breathing deeply, breathing slowly, doing yoga, doing meditation, even doing contemplation and prayer, and better yet, doing something involving movement, like some of the martial arts, the slow, gentle martial arts like Qigong or Tai Chi Chuan, or the more active martial arts like Judo or Kun Tai Do, or some of, and many male veterans especially, but also female veterans, find the martial arts very helpful because it gets them active. It's something that they're prepared to do in terms of their military training, where they've had to go through a lot of rigorous physical exercise, and they find that this is something that can help stabilize their autonomic nervous system. It's something that can help stabilize their reaction time, and it can help pull body and mind and spirit and emotions together.
What about neurofeedback, biofeedback, and the hemi-sync work at
Monroe? Biofeedback, of course, is excellent. Biofeedback, neurofeedback, any of the little machines now that are quite inexpensive to help people relax. You have, if you're members of the audience, know too much about this, you attach little electrodes onto different parts of the brain and body, and when the brain starts racing and emitting a lot of what we call beta waves, very rapid brain waves, the lights start to flash, maybe red lights start to flash, and the task is to slow the brain waves down so you get blue lights instead of red lights.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe there will be a noise, a very high noise. You want to get rid of that high noise and put it into a lower sound. And people learn how to control their brain waves as well as control their heartbeat rate, as well as control their skin perspiration, as well as controlling other aspects of the body that can be monitored by biofeedback machines and the information fed back by either sounds or by something visual. Yes, biofeedback is an extremely helpful tool, and there are now more biofeedback specialists around than there were 10 years ago at Saybrook Graduate School, where I teach. We actually have a certificate program in biofeedback, another certificate program in psychological hypnosis, and many of the students who take these certificate programs then are very well prepared to start to work with traumatized people using these techniques.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think HeartMath has some very reasonably priced machines that help do this.
I'm very happy that you know about HeartMath. We just had the HeartMath people at Saybrook Graduate School doing a seminar, and I think that HeartMath has been doing some excellent work. Remember that I said that the neurotransmitters are not only in the brain, there's a lot of transmitters in the gut, a lot in the heart. And I think the heart can be looked upon as a separate brain.
I do too.
Well, because there are so many neurotransmitters in the heart, there are so many chemical reactions going on in the heart, and there's so much feeling associated with the heart. It's no wonder that heart in ancient legends became associated with emotionality, as with the Sacred Heart of Jesus, as with St. Valentine's Day, as with the heart of the healer. It's such a metaphor. And now we find out there's actually neuroscience which is backing up the emphasis on the heart that's been going back thousands of years.
Yes.
And for those listeners who don't know about the HeartMath Institute, it's in California near the city of Santa Cruz, and it's a research facility, but they have very practical programs, even programs to help school children manage their aggression through different types of training, biofeedback, different types of mental and emotional and physical exercises. And I think that the HeartMath is becoming a very vital psychological and medical force in the therapeutic field.
Yeah, I think Roland told me one time you can get one of those machines for like $200. You know, that's a psychotherapy appointment. And it's portable. You can take it around with you in your pocket.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right.
Okay, my next question is, there is a statement in your book that says, you were talking about a soldier, it never seemed like it was me. It was like watching it from the outside. So they don't...
You have to read that statement once more for me.
It never seemed like it was me committing the acts. So to speak, it was like watching it from the outside. In other words, they were like watching whatever they were doing from a third-party perspective, like it was someone else. So what's going on with them when that happens? Are they detaching from mind, or what's happening?
Okay, what is happening with whom? We just lost our connection. What is happening with whom?
Oh, read it one more time. There's a statement in your book, and you said that the soldier says, you know, it didn't seem like it was me performing that act. It was like watching from the outside, like from a third-party perspective.
Okay, now I've got you. Yes, yes, this is a common statement that many of the veterans make when they're looking back at the traumatic experience. It didn't seem as if it was me. I was looking at it from a distance. This is what we often call dissociation, where somebody who is in the middle of a traumatic experience defends himself or herself by making a split in terms of identity. The trauma is so dreadful, so painful, that they can't abide it, and so they remove themselves from it and watch it going on just like they were watching a motion picture or a stage play. And this dissociation is something then that they don't get rid of easily. It can carry over into daily life once they're back in the civilian world. And they can dissociate from an emotional experience. Their wives, husbands, family might think that they've become very distant. And indeed they are. It's hard for them to be present. And in the here and the now, because that's something that's been painful for them. So this dissociation that they used as a defensive maneuver during combat is something that they can't often shake off that easily, and it maintains itself. And again, the same type of dissociation occurs in other types of trauma. One traumatized man I talked with, who was in an automobile accident, said that when a car hit his car, he just left his body and watched it from above, and all the mangled bodies, including his own and the car wreckage, he was looking at it from above and saw a body, and then he recognized that body was himself. Also, a woman I talked with, who was abused by a relative, said that when he abused her, the pain was so great, she just left her body and she just watched it happening as if she was watching a horror movie. And she said she has never been able to actually come back fully to her body again and has never been able to regain any sexual feeling after that experience. So this dissociation doesn't go away easily. And it's something that really poses a challenge to therapists who are working with veterans and other trauma victims who have gone through this dissociation.
It sounds like that's almost something of the soul, and a lot of therapists don't grasp this.
Well, I've worked a lot with indigenous people and native healers and folk healers. Many of them in Latin America deal with something that they call susto, or soul loss, where an evil spirit takes the soul away and the person is never quite the same. And then the folk healer often makes a journey into the other world and fights the evil spirit to get the soul back, and then comes the process of bringing the soul back into the body. Now, of course, this sounds like it's a little bit superstitious, but actually it's a very similar reaction to what we're talking about in Western psychotherapy when people are trying to heal other people who have had dissociative experiences. Yeah. I actually know a Native American healer by the name of Fawn Journeyhawk, who has worked with veterans and whose specialty is going in search of their soul, because let's say that they have inadvertently killed a civilian and the civilian's ghost is hanging on to their soul in Vietnam or Afghanistan or Iraq or whatever. And so she has to go and plead with the spirit of that dead civilian to release the service man or servicewoman's soul, and so that there can be a healing. Also, it's not necessarily the whole soul that was lost. Some traditions deal with five or six different souls, or with souls that can be sliced or partitioned into several pieces, and sometimes the traumatic experience only leads to the losing of one of those souls.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you translate this into psychological terms, and you have something very, very similar happening in terms of working with dissociation, where the therapist needs to help put body, mind, spirit, and emotions back together again if the person is going to retain or regain functioning and get on with their life, get a worthwhile job, have a worthwhile relationship, and finally have a healing from the traumatic symptoms that they're carrying around with them.
Now, I wasn't going to ask you anything like this, but since you brought it up, I'm going to. A lot of mystics, for lack of a better word, I don't know what to call it, say that when you do drugs or alcohol, you know, something that takes away your awareness, that it leaves an opening, so to speak, that spirits can come in and kind of take over and cause problems. Do you believe that?
Are you talking about substance abuse?
Yes.
Yes. I've talked about this topic with any number of folk healers. And again, Fawn Journeyhawk, who I mentioned, other healers that I've talked about, say that there is a lord of alcohol, a lady of cocaine, a lord of heroin, etc.,
mm-hmm.
a lady of methamphetamine. And when people abuse these substances, the lord or lady, who of course is very evil, comes and steals their soul or part of their soul. Even happens with nicotine. There's a lord of nicotine that preys on the tobacco addicts. And I've actually had more friends die of nicotine addiction than I have of alcoholism or any of the illegal drugs. And the metaphor that these folk healers use is that these are actually like vampires. They're evil spirits.
Mm-hmm.
And the use of these very powerful substances, especially if overused, create an opening in the psyche that can be entered, and the vital essence of the person, the soul, if you will, can be sucked out, eventually leading to addiction and to that person's demise or death. Well, once again, you translate this into Western psychotherapy, and from what we know about addiction, there are centers in the brain that are pleasure centers, and these pleasure centers can be very easily activated by these substances, and once activated, if addiction sets in, they need more and more of the same substance to create the effect,
mm-hmm.
and then they might reach a point where they no longer get high or get pleasure, but they have to keep eating or smoking,
right.
or injecting or the substance, because it'll lead to pain, withdrawal symptoms if they don't do it. So it's a downhill slope from simple experimentation to enjoying the substance, to becoming addicted to the pleasure, and then becoming addicted not to the pleasure, but to avoiding the pain.
You know,
well, you know, the folk healers' use of metaphor and lords and ladies of cocaine and nicotine and alcohol and heroin and methamphetamine aren't so far different than the Western psychotherapists who see this tragedy operating in their office when they're dealing with clients who have substance abuse. Now, of course, many people who are addicted can get on with their lives. The folk healers would say that's because only a part of their soul has been stolen. But you start depriving them of that substance, and then they will steal, or they will barter, or they will sell their bodies in order to get the money, to get the substance, and then they're in trouble. Then the substance, whether it's legal or illegal, becomes a central part of their lives and something that they must maintain at all costs. And then you can honestly say, well, this is another type of soul loss. They've lost their soul to these evil spirits. Or, putting in Western terms, they've lost part of their motivation, part of their attention, and other aspects of their consciousness because of their addictive behavior. And, of course, I should add that addictive behavior is very different from habituation. Some people need to take a medicine, like many diabetics need to take insulin. That is something quite different. That's what we call habituation. That is not addiction. This is a medicine that's actually needed to help them function because of some lack due to a diabetic disorder. There are many types of diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want people who are taking a medication for legitimate medical purposes to think that they have evil spirits hovering over them.
Right, right. We've only got about 17 minutes, so, and I've got a bunch more questions, but I do want to say this. You know, I know to some listeners that those things might sound ridiculous, but Klaus Heinemann, I don't know if you know him, but he's a physicist that's been doing some research on orbs, and he's involved with ISEEM and Noetic Sciences, and he and Michal Ledwith have taken hundreds of thousands of pictures of orbs, but he took one picture of an orb that wasn't light, that it was void of any light, so it sucked in energy, so that would be kind of logical that if something like that came around a person that had an opening, it would suck their energy, or suck their will, or suck their soul, or whatever. So I just thought that was kind of interesting there. So you made another statement that said, Lifton found that a death imagery interrupts the perception of a traumatic incident, and it could jeopardize one's own core belief in his or own general safety. What do you mean by that?
I think that this is a very appropriate metaphor. You used the term sucking their soul. This is something that so many of the veterans with substance abuse problems have talked to me and my co-author, Daryl Paulson, about, that as a result of the trauma and using legal or illegal drugs to deaden the pain of their trauma, they feel that these drugs are, again, like vampires. They're sucking the soul out of them, sucking the vitality out of them, and sucking the motivation out of them. Sigmund Freud was probably wrong about a lot of things, but he was absolutely on target when he said that the mark of mental health is the ability to love and to work. Well, people with post-traumatic stress disorder have difficulties loving and working. And if they have substance abuse as a result of the post-traumatic stress disorders, they have even more of a problem in terms of loving and working, holding down a job, holding down a relationship. By the way, I would add one thing to Freud. I would say, not only the ability to love and to work, but to laugh. I think that a good sense of humor is a mark of good health.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that strikes me in terms of talking to a number of these veterans is that their conversation is so devoid of humor, so devoid of lightness and of joy. And when they start talking about their problems, how difficult life is, it's really no surprise that several hundred have actually committed suicide because they can't get on top of the post-traumatic stress disorder. This is not well publicized, but the number probably reaches into a couple of thousand of veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan. It certainly did after the Vietnam War. There was one estimate that tens of thousands of veterans committed suicide or were in fatal accidents within a couple of years after returning back from Vietnam. And, of course, many, many more people, both Americans and civilians, were killed in Vietnam than are being killed in Iraq. But if the war goes on much longer, let's hope it doesn't, but we might have even more victims, both civilians and veterans, and as a result, more suicides.
One thing I wanted to ask you, this war is different from, say, Vietnam or World War II.
Yes, it's much more different, and I think the crucial reason why it is different from both Vietnam and World War II and even the Korean War is that we do not have a draft. This is a volunteer army, and the fact that it's a volunteer army gives the army and the other services a chance to redact servicemen and women and send them back on another tour of duty and even a third tour of duty. And if they want to advance in the military, they have no choice but to do this. There are some very good movies about this problem. They didn't do well at the box office, but Redacted is one of the movies. Valley of Elijah is another movie. The recent movie Stop Loss, excellent movie. All three of them don't portray the veterans in the complexity that they deserve. They're a little bit stereotyped, but for Hollywood movies, they're still worth seeing because they do get at this problem. But as I say, the fact that it's a volunteer army means that there's not as much protest, there's not as much reaction to the war. You don't have people marching in the streets, taking over universities, storming draft centers, or because there are no draft centers. And you also, thank heavens, don't have returning veterans being called child killers, being spit upon like this disgraceful episode that happened after the Vietnam War. I was certainly not in favor of the Vietnam intervention. I think it was a tragic mistake, but neither was I in favor of the way that the heroic veterans of that war were treated once they came back to civilian life and were simply dumped off the plane, sometimes alone, without any support group. At least the veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan are coming back in groups, so there's a built-in support group right from the time that they come back to the United States. So we have learned some lessons. The veterans are being treated better by the powers that be, and that's another thing that makes the reaction much different and that makes the Iraq and Afghanistan wars much different. And again, we can't really put and lump Afghanistan and Iraq together. These are two very, very different wars. And the situation in the two different countries is quite different. And I don't think we have enough soldiers in either country to do an effective job. Once you get into a situation like this, you really need to have enough personnel to back it up. But one of the reasons is we don't have a draft. We have a volunteer army. And so so we make do with what we have. Sometimes we don't make do very well.
I have one more question. We've got about 8 minutes, but I want to ask this question. You can answer it, and then I want you to take whatever time's left to cover anything that you think's important that I haven't covered. My question is, these soldiers are a little bit different, too, in that they have a lot of time on their hands. That, you know, they're not having to worry about staying alive every second. They have a lot of downtime where they're bored and have too much time to think. How do you think that affects them?
Yes. This is a different war in that the soldiers do have downtime. There's not a front that they go to every day. It's not a battlefield situation with clear-cut boundary lines like there were in the Korean War and the World War II, and much and also in the Gulf War, where there was a battle line. You didn't really have a battle line in Vietnam, which is why we lost the war, because we didn't know how to cope with that type of a situation. We don't have battle lines in Iraq or in Afghanistan either. And so there is considerable downtime, and the downtime saps morale, because the soldiers sit around, and once they start thinking and talking about their situation and what good they are doing and whether they're making any progress, if they don't see evidence of the progress, they talk about it. And then people come back with stories about the latest atrocity or the latest bombing or the latest casualty, that time on their hands can be very devastating to morale. Now, on the other hand, it's only fair to say that overall the morale in Iraq is surprisingly high, much higher, in my opinion, than it was in Vietnam, especially in the latter days of the war. And the successes that have occurred within the past year in Iraq, I think, are something that boost soldiers' morale. They can actually see some results of what they are doing and what the Iraqi troops are doing once they get some training. And this is sort of reinforcing the resolve. This is reinforcing the fact that they see some meaning in their life, some meaning in their tour of duty. Without the existential meaning, the morale is going to suffer. And I think that the armed services could maybe even do an even better job of finding ways to boost morale in terms of entertainment, in terms of bringing in even more entertainers than the heroic men and women who have gone over to entertain the troops, in terms of letter writing, in terms of encouragement to the soldiers and other members of the armed forces who are on the front lines and who are serving. And that's one way of getting over this downtime problem, which is really very, very severe. And you asked if there was one thing that we haven't mentioned. Yes, we have not mentioned the brain injury that goes right along with some forms of post-traumatic stress disorder. The fact that that we finally are improving the protection of the soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan, which we weren't doing for many, many years, means that they're not dying, but they are suffering from brain injury because the shrapnel is getting into their heads. And so we have many brain-injured soldiers coming back. I was talking with one woman back from Afghanistan. She has shrapnel in her body that will be there for the rest of her life. Thank heavens it's not in her brain. And so we need a whole different group of rehabilitationists and occupational therapists to work with veterans who have one sort of combat-induced brain injury or the other.
We got about 2 minutes. Do we have proper diagnostic codes and insurance coverage for these injuries?
I have to say that we do have some excellent diagnostic tools for PTSD. We have some excellent diagnostic tools for brain injury. These have come out of psychology and out of medicine over the past several years. The problem is there's not enough people trained to do the diagnosis and to interpret the diagnosis. And this would be a very, very useful use of government money, of public money, to train more people to do the diagnosis, train more people to do the therapy, and encourage veterans to seek out the therapy that's available without having it in any way reflect upon their military career, if this is going to be their vocation and their life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So tell us one more time, we've got about a minute left, where to find you. Your book is Haunted by Combat, and it's an excellent book. More information than I'd ever even thought.
Absolutely. I think that the easiest way to get the book Haunted in Combat by Paulson and Krippner is to go to the bookstore, to go to Amazon.com, to go to BarnesandNobles.com, where you can get it a little less expensively. And the stories in the book are real stories. They're not exactly cheerful stories, but I think they're enlightening, and I think they're ennobling, and I think that they will all demonstrate the heroism of the men and women in our armed forces in these six wars that we talk about in the book.
Thank you so much, Dr. Krippner, for coming on. I wish we had another hour.
And thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure.
It was a pleasure to have you. Good night, and thank you for all you do. Good night.
Good night, and bless you, too.